Hi, this is Dave. Welcome to my channel. Today we have a special guest over a Skype interview. It's Rob Maurer from Tesla Daily Podcast. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Dave. How are you doing?
Good, good. I've known Rob for quite a while, since the early days of Tesla, back like 2013-14 on Tesla Motors Club. And Rob ventured out to start a Tesla Daily Podcast. It's been going on, what, for like 2.5 or 3 years almost?
Yeah, almost 2.5 years. August 2017 started, so yeah, 2.5.
Okay, great. And I remember being an early interview guest. I think it was back like in January or
you
February
were the first
2018.
One.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fantastic.
You were the first interview I did, yeah.
Yeah, I'd just gotten my Model 3, one of the first earlier ones, and I was sharing kind of my assessment of the Model 3 and Tesla's kind of, you know, chances of really making it big. Yeah, so tell me, Rob, you know, we've been talking on and off over the years. Like, what, with your podcast, what really kind of motivated you to start this podcast, and what keeps you going? I mean, it's like, must be a ton of work to do this, you know, every day.
Yeah, for sure. For me, what originally motivated me was just the amount of misinformation that was out there on Tesla at the time. I mean, from the mainstream media outlets, like, it seemed like every day there was some sort of article, whether it be about, you know, battery fires in Tesla vehicles, or, you know, something that Elon Musk said taken out of context, just constant misinformation or missing context. And for me, you know, you as a TMC forum member have seen that a lot. Like, there's a lot of context that people are able to add from that forum, and it's been a great resource over the years. So just seeing the disconnect between like the information there and the information in the mainstream media, not everyone has time to read through hundreds of posts on, you know, forums every single day. So I wanted to sort of, since I was doing that and taking, you know, multiple, you know, 2-3 hours a day, even just reading about Tesla, I wanted to put that time to good use and help keep other people informed that may not have the time to dig through the minutiae of what's happening every single day with Tesla. And at that point I had, you know, some friends that I had talked to about Tesla that had started investing, and when they would see articles like this, they would always ask me, you know, what's going on? Like, is this a big deal or not? So I just wanted to be able to provide that context both to them and to other people. And then for me, the decision to do it daily was just like also a personal decision. I wanted to become a better speaker. So I figured, you know, if I'm doing something every single day, that'll happen over time. So that was just sort of a little personal reason for me.
So how long does it take like to prep like a audio podcast? Let's say if it's not a YouTube video, just like, you know, one of your daily podcasts.
Yeah, just the audio.
Yeah.
It really depends. It depends on the day. It depends on the news cycle. So obviously, if Tesla has earnings, you know, that's going to be 8 or 10 hours working on that. When I was doing, so this is my full-time job now, doing this sort of stuff. And prior to this, I did have another job. So I would do that for 50 hours a week. And then I would probably spend, I don't know, 30 hours a week on the podcast. So whatever that boils down to, you know, 4 hours a day, maybe on average. So it was a lot there for a while. And, you know, I'm still working, you know, quite a bit as well, just, you know, other things that have taken up that time.
Got it. So like when you added your YouTube channel, I guess it was what, end of last year or so?
Yeah, I think it was like December where I really started actually doing any video sort of stuff on there.
Yeah, so how long does that like add to the whole, you know, weekly workload for you?
It adds a lot. It really depends like how detailed I am with the video, and I'm still sort of figuring out my process, as I'm sure, because you started YouTube around the same time, right?
Yeah, around December of last year, so yeah.
Yeah, so I'll be curious to hear your thoughts on this too, but it kind of depends. You know, if I'm on camera, that can be a little bit quicker from an editing perspective. Oftentimes nowadays, I'm just doing more of, you know, if I'm talking about an article, I'll pull the article up and sort of, you know, scroll through that and, you know, add different graphics or graphs or charts or things like that. So if I'm creating, you know, extra content like that, it can take longer. If I'm just me on camera talking, obviously that takes a lot less time. But I would say, you know, maybe it adds an hour or two a day. Just kind of depends.
Got it.
What about you?
Yeah, I mean, man, YouTube is a monster. I mean, like, it's a time suck too, right? Because you like, for me personally, like, YouTube is kind of a side thing, you know. I have my own business to run, you know. I have like a software company actually, with full time employees, and I'm running the show. And so to do YouTube is like this extra thing that I just kind of wanted to try out, and it's like the whole process of me just, you know, doing my own research is one thing, and then to try to package it in a way where people can understand, you know, it takes a lot of time. And then the whole editing process, like, I'm like, right now I'm editing my own videos. I had to let go of my editor who I use for like about 10 videos or maybe 15 or so. But it's like, Yeah, it takes a lot of time, So I don't know, I'm still trying to figure it out. There's a balance of like I could spend a ton of time on editing and trying to make my production really high quality, but then that'll lower the quantity of content, right? And so I'm kind of erring on the side of I just want to get stuff out because I just want it's more for a personal thing. I kind of want the stuff that I'm processing. I just want it out. I don't really prioritize if it looks great right now, but who knows, later on, in a year or two, we'll see where that leads.
Yeah, and that's kind of what's fun about it is just, learning over time what your audience likes, what you like, and what works best for everybody.
So what's your like motivation? Like what motivates you to like put in all this time and effort, into all this production research and all this stuff?
It's a really good question. I mean, it's sort of something that just fell into my lap a little bit. I never imagined that I would be a YouTuber or a podcaster or anything like that because, as I said, one of the reasons I started the podcast was to become a better speaker. I thought of that as a weakness for myself personally. So over time, that's obviously improved, but never something I would have really imagined for myself. For me, what motivates me is really just getting good information out there. Just over the years, I've become so frustrated. And I think once you learn a lot about a subject and you become an expert in that subject, you can start to realize like how much poor information is out there. And for me, that's what I hate. Like I just hate stuff that is incorrect or missing context or misleading. So whenever I see something like that, it's very motivating to try to, set the record straight and to just really get accurate information out there.
Got it. I'm curious, like actually one of my Twitter followers was asking if you had to do a podcast, a daily podcast on a single other company other than Tesla, like what would that company be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. If I would have been doing this 10 years ago, easy answer, like it would have been Apple. That was sort of the first company that, I invested in. And I've always just had a natural interest in the stock market. But that was when I started to actually, make some money and be able to invest. That was when Apple was starting to become a thing in the iPod Touch days before the iPhone. So that would have been, an easy choice for me. That was the only other company that I've really felt the way that I've felt about Tesla in terms of the potential of the company. Right now, in our current environment, there's not another company that I necessarily feel that way about. I'm sure there are other companies out there that I'm just not aware of. If I had to pick one, it would probably be SpaceX, but I feel like that's kind of a cop-out answer just because of the Elon connection. But yeah, other than that, I mean, I don't see a company out there right now that I would be able to or have the interest in covering like I do for Tesla right now.
Got it. Have there been any companies kind of on your radar that's just like, let's say you couldn't invest in Tesla at all, right? Let's say it was barred from you. Like, what would be the first like few companies you would say, "Hey, I'm gonna start researching." Not necessarily buy, right? But you're saying, "Hey, this is intriguing. I think I need to really look into these stocks." What would those like maybe first two or three companies be?
It's a really good question. I wish I had a better answer. If I did, my portfolio would be more diversified. It's very heavily concentrated in Tesla right now, just because I haven't really found another opportunity like that. I mean, the time of Apple, there were a couple other investments that intrigued me. I have a decent amount in Netflix. I have a decent amount in Amazon. Right now, though, I feel like those companies are so big that the potential for return is diminished just because of the size they've already grown to. So I don't, for me, my whole philosophy in investing is really, and I think you have a pretty similar one. I'm looking for things that I can sort of 10x my money on that I have pretty high confidence in. There are a lot of small cap companies that can have a lot of potential for 10x, but you can't necessarily have the level of confidence in those stocks. And that's why I think Tesla is really uniquely positioned because to me, like the future of the company is extremely clear. Like there are certainly different scenarios that can play out, but the direction and the magnitude of the direction, which is generally how I try to invest, is extremely clear. And I feel like it's pretty rare to find those things. So yeah, again, kind of a non-answer there, but there just aren't a lot of other companies out there that I'm seeing right now that fit sort of that investment model for me personally. Do you have companies in your set
Well,
that
it was interesting because I asked on my Twitter account, like, hey, what are some potential 10x companies out there? Or if you could invest in Tesla, what would you invest in, to do a 10x, right? And my question was like, hey, you have $1 billion that you have to invest in non-Tesla. And if it goes to $10 billion in 10 years, then you get to keep the whole 10 billion. But if it doesn't reach 10 billion, then it's taken completely 100% away from you, right? So which company would you invest in? And it was interesting, a lot of people pick like, Microsoft or Google or Apple or Amazon. And I'm like, are you serious? I'm replying like, do you think Amazon is going to be like $11.5 trillion company or Microsoft, $13 trillion company in 10 years? And I was looking up like, what's the total market cap for like the entire, all the companies in the US stock exchanges, right? And it's only like $25 trillion or so. So you think like, okay, yeah, oh no, Microsoft's going to 10x or Amazon or Google, whatever. But are they really going to be 10, to $15 trillion companies? Like, half the the total market cap of today's U.S. stock exchange. I don't think a lot of people understand, like, the market cap concept, but also that these companies are already at trillion-dollar market caps. So I mean, it's like the bigger you get, there just are a finite number of markets, with billions or trillions of dollars of, revenue potential, and it ends up all these companies are going to be fighting over each other. That's how it ends. It doesn't end up where everyone, ends up 10xing, I think. Yeah, it's difficult to find that 10x. Yeah, I've been doing a deep dive. Actually, this whole coronavirus situation, man, it's taught me a lot, and it's got me to thinking that I do need to spread out my bets a bit. And I do need to, I think, get into some other companies. My whole thing though is like with investing, I see so much potential with the big wins. That like, for example, take a stock like Google, like with YouTube, like, I'm bullish on YouTube. They have Android, they have search, they have like, and Google's like a international global company, right? They're not going to easily be displaced. But the challenge with Google is, yeah, it could 2x, or 3x over the next 5 to 10 years. But it's like, for some reason, for that to be like my main objective is to 2x or 3x, it's just seems a little bit like in my situation where I already have kind of separate assets that kind of cover kind of living expenses and retirement stuff. It seems like I kind of should utilize my energy for something a little bit bigger. And that's where, I've been looking to some other companies. But what do you think of Square? Do you have a Square Cash App?
I don't have it personally. I don't really have much need for it. I do think it's interesting. I also think Stripe is interesting, though I haven't necessarily looked into many of these companies specifically. But I do think the payments world is one of those areas where there's a ton of potential, and there's obviously going to be disruption happening in it. And like you said, there's a finite number of trillion-dollar market potential areas, and that's obviously one of them easily. So if I had to go in a direction, I think probably something in that arena would be where I would look first, I guess.
I was kind of discounting Square because I'd done an initial kind of, dive into them, and like it just seemed a little bit scattered. And I kind of, as a developer, as a person in software, I kind of lean towards Stripe just because they execute so well. But I decided to take a second look last week, and I started to just listen to about 5 or 10 of these Jack Dorsey interviews on Stripe and what kind of their vision and strategy is. And I came away actually kind of, my eyes were opened actually. I'm like, wow, he's actually doing what Elon wanted to do with PayPal in a sense. Kind of like let people bring in their money directly into the ecosystem and never have a need to take the money out, because you provide them with all a credit card or debit card, you provide them with interest, you provide them with stocks. Did you know they actually allow you to buy stocks now? It's kind of crazy in your
Oh, no, I
app.
didn't.
Yeah, so
That
it's
is
like,
interesting.
and you can get loans right in the Cash App, even buy Bitcoin. So they're kind of trying to do all the functionality of a bank, and you can add money so easily, so quickly. You just type in your debit card number and the amount you want to add, and like 5 seconds is in your Cash App.
Do you know what their market cap is right now?
Yeah, their market cap is what is it? It's about
Sure, we can look it up quick.
I don't want to like mislead people here, but yeah, market cap is $25 billion. It's interesting because, yeah, I mean, they went down to a low of what, $32, during the bottom or the first bottom. We'll see what happens. And they were up, what, before this whole thing at about 80 or so, right? Before this whole thing came crashing down.
Yeah, 86 looks like the peak, roughly.
In the past few years they've been kind of around the 40 to 80, 60 to 80 mark. Kind of more of a stable kind of like stock price for a while. But yeah, I think the big thing with Square Cash or Square is that they're bringing on so many people into their Cash App so fast. It's like this viral thing right now. And they're able to monetize right now their people. I think it was like $30 a year per person, per active user. But I think that's going to scale to like probably 60 to eventually $100 to $200 per user, right, on the Cash App. But this Cash App is one of the most popular apps in the App Store. It's so viral because everyone's just changing money. And so if they can actually monetize per user, and this Cash App, I think they're at 24 million users at the end of last year. But if they go up to 100, 200, 300, 400 million users, and they can monetize each user, let's say $100 or $200 a year, you're looking at a mega company right there, you know? And they just seem to be executing quite well. And so that's kind of like the play is, fine, they have 24 million, but look at their growth rate, right? They're at like 16 million or something the year before. I think it's going over 50% per year or something. Yeah, just look at the compound growth rate, you know, over time. You know, I think people misunderstand or don't like appreciate compound growth, right? I mean, I know you've talked about that sometimes, like, but you know, just like think, oh, 50% per year, like who cares, right? You know, the question though is always like, can that be sustainable, right? Can you do 50% for like 5 or 10 years out? And if you can, the numbers are just staggering, right? It's just like, it always surprises people, you know, compound
Yeah,
growth.
absolutely.
Yeah.
That's one of the first things that sort of attracted me to investing is just understanding that at an early age, just like how impactful it is when you can 10x and then 10x again.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I did this thing for my wife about a year ago. I said, okay, if we did kind of, you know, investing at a 25% annual growth rate, right, versus let's say 10%, like what would be the difference over 40 years? Like, you know,
That's a long time too.
it was like, you know, crazy billions and billions of dollars, right? It was just like ridiculous. And she's like, is that true? Is that real? And I'm like, no, seriously, just work, look at the numbers, you know? It's
Yeah, even
fascinating.
1% your annual return is hugely impactful over that time frame.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I just recorded a video actually 2 days ago on compound interest. I'll probably release it this week. It's yeah, definitely a
Nice.
foundational skill. Have you looked into any kind of genetic biotech stocks or, you know, gene editing, any of that stuff? Any of ARK portfolio stocks at all?
No, I like ARK in general. I think they do a good job. I haven't looked into it personally because it's not my area of expertise. I'm definitely more in like the consumer segment just because that's what I can understand most easily. And I think for me, when I have a concentrated investing philosophy, I really need to have an incredibly strong understanding of what I'm investing in to be confident to be as concentrated as I am. And for me, that often ends up being in the consumer space, like what I said, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, now Tesla. So that's sort of my wheelhouse personally. And because I'm not diversified, I sort of steer clear of those other areas. Even finance for some ex to some extent, like I'm just not as well versed in the intricacies of transactional finance and things like that as I am in the consumer segment. So that's where I tend to focus most of my time and energy just because I think personally it's my niche for understanding.
Got it. So, going back to Tesla here. So, what's your kind of investment type of approach? Are you all stock, or do you go, you know, long dated options, leaps, or do you do a combination, or do you kind of switch off as the stock goes up or down? Like, kind of what's your strategy?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. I mean, I have my core shares that I've just accumulated over the years. I sort of had a share target that I wanted to get to. And then I, you know, over time worked my way up to that target. And then over the years, I have done trading in, you know, deep in the money leaps, anywhere from that to trading an option for a single day that expires that day. So the whole gamut of options I've played with, it's generally a really small percent of my portfolio though. That I'm doing that with, unless it's something more like the deep in the money leaps, that can be a little bit more because that's a little bit less risky. But yeah, it kind of runs the whole gamut for me right now. I'm in all stock and then just some cash. I think the recovery in the markets has been a little bit too quick, and I'm not sure that everything is really being accounted for in terms of the economic fallout that the whole coronavirus situation is going to cause. That theory has been really poor so far because the markets have risen, you know, whatever 20, 30% in the last month. But for me, I still have concern about where what this leads to. Even if there is a quick recovery in terms of the actual coronavirus, I still think there's a lot of fallout that's going to happen over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months.
Got it. So, with coronavirus, what's in the economy? What's your kind of like base case, like most probable case going forward in the next 6 to 12 months in terms of with the disease, but also with the economy?
Yeah, I think for me, I'm looking for sort of like a staggered restart of everything. I think there's going to be businesses that restart more quickly than others. Obviously, you know, manufacturing, I think, is going to be one of those things. But when we talk about service industries, I don't see any way that we can go back to normal until there's a lot better infrastructure in place for handling the coronavirus. And by infrastructure, I mean medical infrastructure, whether that means capacity for care or whether that means testing or vaccinations. Until we see more of that, people can't just go and hang out in a bar like they used to. And that's going to impact the economy. And that's going to, you know, the question is, how much does it impact the economy? But there's definitely going to be an impact. So I'm sort of looking for like a staggered restart. And it's, to me, I'm just kind of looking for signs of how that all happens, if that makes sense.
Well, okay. So what's the most important thing, you think, with, you know, getting the economy back up and running?
For me, that's probably testing and vaccinations.
Okay.
I think it's a common problem. Like, it's, you need data. Uh-huh. If you're trying to answer any question, you need data. And to get data, we need testing. So the more testing we have, the better the data is, and the more confident we can be to resume activities if you're testing negative, or to isolate if you're testing positive. Mm-hmm. And that's incredibly important with coronavirus, because you can spread it asymptomatically. So if we don't have robust and widespread testing, it's going to continue to spread. Unless there is, you know, unless there's a seasonal component, which sort of remains to be seen. But from what I've read so far, it doesn't seem like it's going to be super impactful from a seasonality perspective, at least.
Okay. So do you see this?
I'd be curious to hear.
Do you see it kind of going through the summer, kind of like, and then still being around next winter?
Yeah, unfortunately I do. I think we're going to be in a lot better position to work through it. But then the question remains of what's the impact of, or what are the costs that we have to bear to be able to work through it.
Got it. And then the stock market, do you think the stock market is fully ingesting the economic realities over the next 6 to 12 months, basically?
Yeah, it's so tough. I mean, my instinct was no, but then you have these, you know, you have these things like the bailout, and you have 0% interest rates, and you have just a bunch of money being pumped into the market. And personally, I don't have a good way to determine how that should change the valuation of the market. So it's really hard to get a grasp on what really the market should be priced at. And for me, it doesn't necessarily matter all that much, because I'm going to continue to invest in Tesla, and my investment horizon is going to continue to be a long time. And I think relative to my other investment opportunities, Tesla's going to come out ahead. So if I know those kind of three things, that's all I really need to know, unless I'm doing trading, which I do, because I think I can make some extra money doing that, and partially because it is interesting and I learn a lot doing it. So, the short answer is I don't know. I feel like I know, but I just don't know the impacts of some of those things.
Got it.
What are your thoughts on all that? Because I really want to hear your thoughts too.
I mean, it's like it's fascinating times, because like this economic shock is unprecedented in terms of the drastic, like 100 to zero, you know, and then like going to zero, and then like what's the restart gonna look like, you know, how fast is the ramp up back? And it's also fascinating how different countries are taking different approaches, right? Like in South Korea, it's like they barely have skipped a beat, you know. I have some friends I know who live there, and they're like, yeah, we still go out to eat in restaurants and, you know, hang out and whatever. And they kind of, you know, leave a seat open in between every table and stuff, but people are free to go out. And it gives me a lot of like hope, in the sense that if every country in the world was just slammed and no one was mitigating the virus, right, then I'd be like, oh my gosh, like this is crazy, you know, sell basically. <Yeah. laughs> But you know, you do have these outliers, right? You have these countries that are doing pretty well with it, and so that means that there's actually a solution, right? An apparent one, something that you just need to use your brain and actually like do some copying and thinking. And so that actually gives me a lot of hope that we're going to be able to get ourselves out of this, implement some things, you know. Like I've been a big fan of masks for, you know, a few months now. And just because it just makes sense, you know, stick something in front of your face, right? It's gonna improve a lot of things. I think just masks alone is probably gonna do an amazing amount to mitigate, you know, the spread. Economic impact, I mean, this is a tricky one. I personally think there is a seasonal element to this whole thing. Personally, just because every respiratory viral illness almost across the board has some seasonality to it. So I wouldn't be surprised in the US with the summer months. And also, I think this virus actually, you know, it actually doesn't do well in like hotter environments. It's not like the strongest virus just left alone. I think the summer we're gonna see a dip. US economy, we're gonna get restarted. And then we're going to see this thing crop up again in October, November, and we're going to have to start implementing certain things. But hopefully by then we'll be smarter. Hopefully by then we'll have more testing capacity. You know, hopefully by then we'll have some more treatment that actually works and has been effective. And there'll be hopefully some, you know, vaccine testing and all that stuff. But yeah, it's a tricky road, you know. I
Yeah, and
mean,
I do agree that there's likely to be some seasonality. I just don't think it's like something that completely goes away. I think influenza probably is going to have more of a seasonal dip in the summer than like what we would see from coronavirus.
Got it. Going back to like trading and stuff, like do you ju how do you mitigate your kind of losses? You know, do you just trade small amounts basically so you know you don't lose your whole pile, or how do you approach that?
Yeah, I don't often hedge. I have on occasion hedged some positions. So in those cases, that means buying, you know, a put, for example, for a more leveraged long position, just in case things go in an opposite direction of what I expect. But yeah, generally, I'm just trying to take advantage of what I perceive as an information advantage in the market. So if there is a time that I feel like that's when I'll make an options bet based on something. And you know, I make my own assessment of how long it might take the market to sort of understand that thing that I'm betting on. You know, one of the big ones, I was pretty leveraged back in, I think, 2018, just based on the Model 3 ramp up, because I think the market didn't really fully understand Tesla's ambition there and ability to succeed in that. And yeah, Tesla was behind and they didn't hit their own targets, but clearly the market didn't expect that from the start anyway. So, those are the kind of things that, you know, if I perceive a mispricing that I'll try to take advantage of. Unfortunately, it seems like Wall Street still can lag behind even when you might expect them to understand. And I've actually been pretty surprised with Tesla's, I guess, more the market's ability to understand Tesla and the surge in price that we've seen. I think it's totally justified, but the market now seems to sort of understand it. And even with oil going down like a couple of days ago, or yeah, even yesterday, we didn't see where in past years we would have seen, you know, Tesla dip on that, because the theory is, okay, if oil's cheap, then people don't want electric vehicles anymore. And there used to be a bit of correlation there, but now, you know, Tesla barely even reacted. It was down the same percent as the Nasdaq. So, I've actually been pretty surprised at how the understanding has grown in the market for Tesla specifically.
Got it. Like did I'm just curious, like last year, you know, April-ish 2019, Tesla dipped under
I remember
$200. Like what was going through your head there?
Yeah, so I think I told you this at the Model Y event, but I actually got a margin call back then because I was on, as I said, pretty leveraged at that point in time, both with margin and call options. So it was something I dealt with. You know, I sold some other positions in those other stocks that I mentioned, like Apple and Amazon, that I felt weren't as good a value for Tesla at that time. Just held on to as much Tesla as I could and, you know, waited it out. And I stayed a little bit leveraged, not quite as leveraged as I had been, but just wanted to make sure that I would capture that upside if and when it did come. And thankfully, a lot of the positions that I had were, you know, around the would have been Jan 20 expiration. So I still held a lot of those when we were back in that 600 range. So I ended up making out really well. I haven't gone back to see, you know, what it would have been without, you know, taking those leverage positions versus not getting margin called and things like that, because I don't really care. It's in the past. But yeah, it was a difficult time for sure. I think Tesla's Q1 last year definitely caught a lot of people off guard, including myself, particularly around like the S&X numbers dropping from 27,000 to 12,000 in a quarter.
Do you
But
think like have you seen like kind of an influx of newer Tesla investors, you know, retail investors getting into trading options, et cetera, and kind of having kind of a very bullish, you know, let's say, view of Tesla,
yeah.
like What do you think? Like, I don't know. For me, I'm like, I've gone through so many ups and downs, and the future sometimes looks so bright, and you're like, oh my gosh, I bet on that, and it could turn out something like so different. But these newer people in the stock, in the company, they don't have that type of history. They just see things, I think, sometimes through like these rosy glasses. Like, I don't know. Have you observed anything like that? Just curious.
Yeah, I think that's just common, like investor psychology for newer investors. They haven't, especially if they haven't lived through a bear market, which, a lot of people that are coming into money now and starting to invest for the first time haven't lived through that, like the 2008 financial crisis, for example. So obviously now they've got some of that experience with everything that's happened in the last 3 months. But yeah, I think that's common. And then with Tesla being, one of the darlings of the stock market over the last 6 months, it makes sense for people to get into it. Plus, it's again consumer facing, which I think helps that sort of influx of retail investors.
Yeah, one Twitter follower asked me to ask you this question. He says, help us with our option trades. How leveraged should we be here? Is it too much to risk to be in June 2022, 1800 option calls at this point, given the macro situation? Should we move entirely into stock? And so I was like June, like, I mean, like, I was like thinking like June 22nd, like, is it like 2020, option, like 18, I'm like, wait, my first reaction was, is 800? Are you talking about 800 call, 800 strike calls, right? I'm like, why would you do 1800? And then he's like, no, June 2020 or 2022, right? So basically in
Yeah, so 2 years now.
he's betting that stock will be above $1,800 plus the amount that, it costs for his contract just to break even. Like, what do you think about that? Should he go for it?
First, I will disclaimer this with saying, like, I never give anyone any specific options advice because everyone's positions are different. Everyone has their own risk tolerance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For me personally, you can definitely make a positive trade on those options. I mean, you don't have to necessarily have Tesla go above $1,800 per share to make a good return on that. Tesla could go up $50 next week and you could sell it and you could make, I don't know, 30% on it, something like that. So there's definitely an opportunity there. In terms of Tesla being able to hit that share price, I mean, what would that be? Tesla's $130 billion market cap right now at $700 per share. So that'd be, 260 plus, let's call it like $300 billion or something. I don't know if Tesla can get there in 2022. It would probably depend on full self-driving showing pretty extreme progress, which is definitely possible. So if you want to bet on it, that's probably a decent position to bet on that. I haven't looked at the price, so I don't know what the premium is on that. But I mean, that's what's interesting about options is there's so many different ways for you to profit on them and so many different trades you can make, whether you're buying or selling. So specifically buying that option, I do think there's some potential there, but it's not like I would bet my whole portfolio on it. It'd be a small position.
Yeah, like usually when I hear a question like that, I immediately know that the person is more of a novice because they otherwise wouldn't be asking like that type of question, like, oh, 1800 strike calls, right? So I know it's not necessarily probably like a strategic, just quick in and out. A lot of people are really thinking like Tesla's going to be like $2,000 or $3,000 in 2 years or something, right? Yeah, I just like, yeah, it's kind of concerning to me actually. I think people get disconnected to the realities of market cap, and yeah, I think a lot of people are going to lose money if they just listen to, for example, certain price targets from certain funds that are claiming what 5,000 or 10,000 or $15,000 golden goose. Like, what do you think about a $15,000 golden goose scenario in like within
Was
4 years?
that their 5-year target?
For
Can't
you, end
remember.
of 2024, I believe. Yeah.
If full self-driving happens, I mean, I can see, I feel like that just kind of like wrecks every model. If Tesla could actually have robotaxis like later this year and they can have a couple of years to actually scale that business up and get market share in the ride sharing business, like, sure. I don't, what would the market cap for that be? Like 800 billion or something like that? I'd
Oh,
have to look at the
no.
math, but
15,000 dollar stock price.
15,000. So
We're talking
what's that,
about
20
like
times?
Yeah, we're talking
So
about
that's like a
what?
2.5 trillion then.
Exactly. Yeah.
So not in 4 years. Definitely not in 4 years.
Yeah,
Maybe in
see.
14 years.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm like, have you guys figured out like the market cap? Like, are you really thinking Tesla's gonna be $2 or $3 trillion market company like in like 4 years? It's like mind boggling. Yeah, there's a lot of mind boggling stuff going on out there.
Yeah, I
Anyways.
think even if the direction is clear, it's just like it doesn't happen that quickly. Like even if
Yeah,
Tesla's on the
yeah,
path to get
yeah.
there, the fundamentals aren't going to support a $2.5 trillion valuation that quickly, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, they also like, I've been preaching this for like 8 years, not 8 years, but like for the longest time of like people get so excited with Elon's timelines, They're like,
Yeah.
but it's like you have to have a filter. It's like a filter of interpreting his timelines. Like someone should create some type of like
Definitely.
program, where you type in like something and it filters like what the reality is, right? But yeah, the reality is they're trying to roll out this full self-driving, right, by the end of the year. But what are the chances that you're going to see a robotaxi by the end of this year? It's like what? I mean, less than 1%. I mean, I don't want to call it less than 1%, but like, okay, less than
Yeah.
5% chance. I mean, even less than that, I mean, like, come on. It's like, unless you have like drivers, physical drivers in the robotaxi, right, that are driving. But to have actually a robotaxi unmonitored, no chaperone, like, we're not going to see that this year. And are we even going to see it next year? I mean, what's your take? Are we going to see a non-chaperone, like, Tesla robotaxi next year?
Like paid robotaxi
Yeah,
service
paid
comes and picks you
robotaxi
up and drops
service,
you off.
like,
Yep.
yeah, next year. Are we going to even see that?
No, I would say, yeah, I would agree with you, less than 1% chance of that this year. I mean, Elon has been pretty clear the last couple of times. He's talked about the full self-driving feature set and saying like it'll get the job done in some cases some of the time. It's not like he's changed his communication there, thankfully, a little bit, to be a lot more conservative and I think more accurate in terms of what he's talking about. So yeah, I would agree. Very minimal chance of that happening this year. Next year, I want to wait and see how this core autopilot rewrite functions. I think everything we've heard out of Tesla, whether it's from Elon or from, other parties, employees that have left the company, whatever the case may be, everyone has been really excited about this rewrite. So if we see this rewrite and it's a huge step forward, that could change my opinion on the potential. But at this point, yeah, I would be surprised if there's a paid robotaxi service next year. But I think when we get into that, 12, 16-month range, the possibilities, increase, obviously, maybe above, 1%.
Sure. Yeah, I'm just like
Still small.
Like I'm super bullish on robotaxi. I think it's a complete game changer. I mean, this is
Me
like
too.
gonna drive, Tesla's valuation going forward over the next 5 or 10 years. It's just that I think it's a timing issue. It's like, yeah, does it really come out this year or next year, and how fast does it roll out? And when I look at all the complexity involved of what it takes, not just on the technology side, but also on the adopter side, it's like, and the government side. I mean, this is majorly complex. We're talking about lives, danger. It's either death, life or death. And this type of stuff doesn't roll out very fast. That's one of the reasons why, like, you still have to monitor autopilot on the freeway because it's a life and death issue. If it wasn't so, then you could just forget it, just fall asleep. But we still can't even fall asleep on the freeway, right? Yet we're talking
Right,
about
exactly.
unchaperoned, right, robotaxi service this year, right? And I think guys want to pop the bubble with people, hey, that's not gonna happen, and pop the bubble is not gonna, I don't think it's gonna happen next year unless we see some dramatic, like crazy, like revolutionary, like step changes, right? Which could happen, but even that, like, I think best case is like, hey, maybe 2022 we start to see some limited rollouts, and then the scaling I think also takes time. Yeah, it's a complex issue.
Yeah, for me, what I always come back to is like I don't really care about the timeline. What I care about is Tesla's competitive position, and I feel like they're in the best competitive position. They're the only one that has the ability to capture the amount of data that is required to solve this problem, in my opinion. And I don't see that changing. So whether it's 2021, 2022, 2026, 2030, Tesla's in the best position to capture that upside, and I'm invested in that. So for me, that's the win. Like that's what I
Definitely.
need to know.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my approach is, especially when you're invested in stock, you can kind of just sit
Right. If you're
back and
trading, it's
take
different, but
exactly.
stock's
You're,
good.
if you're invested in a stock, you're like, hey, it doesn't matter if it's a 2-year or 5-year timeline, they're still number one in a multi-trillion-dollar market. This is fantastic. But if you've got like, options that are expiring like in 6 or 12 months, depending on the rollout of robotaxi, I think yeah, people need to reconsider that.
Yes, I agree with
Yeah,
that.
yeah,
And options
definitely.
premiums are super high right now because we've had such,
Yeah.
you know, crazy volatility. So that's something to keep in mind, especially if you're newer to options, is you're paying quite a price on those options. And yeah, it could still pay off, but they're, I think, more expensive now than they've really ever been. So it's just even more risky.
Yeah, definitely. What do you think in terms of, let's say, Tesla, going back to Tesla, you know, a lot of people don't talk about the risks of Tesla because I think partly like, you know, the shorts are so focused on, you know, Tesla going bankrupt, all this stuff, and the bulls to defend Tesla, right? They defend the positives, but oftentimes the risks, you know, aren't talked about. Yeah, what are the what's is there any big risk you're seeing? Like, for example, this whole coronavirus pandemic, right? It was kind of like a black swan risk. Who was predicting this a year ago? Right. Maybe there are some people
Yeah,
like, you
nobody.
know, random people writing books saying that we have to think about it or prepare for it. But in terms of like it actually happening, it's like it came out of the blue. What do you think? Are there any kind of black swan things for Tesla, like big risks that just come out of the blue and just like boom, wipe out, you know, the potential future, you know, of Tesla?
Yeah. I mean, when we're talking about something like that, like a black swan, I think Elon's said it a couple times, like a force majeure would be problematic, obviously, especially if it were to, you know, something were to happen in Fremont, like, I don't know, a meteor hits it or there's a massive
Sure.
earthquake or something like that. Like, that would be extremely problematic for the company. But Tesla's taken great steps to diversify their risk in terms of their production process, you know, with Gigafactory Shanghai, Gigafactory Berlin. So I think even that force majeure, we're starting to move past the major risks of that, at least as long as it's not like a global force majeure, in which case, well, you know, pick your poison. You're going to be in a bad spot regardless of what company you're invested in. So yeah, it's something I spend a ton of time thinking about. For me, I think it's easy to answer what I don't view as risks. I don't view competition as risk. I think Tesla's, you know, head and shoulders above anyone else, whether that's legacy or new startups. It's just not something that I view as having potential to, you know, change Tesla's path. And then when I think about things that could be for me, I don't know, maybe like the supply chain, especially as Tesla tries to grow as aggressively as they plan to. And we saw some hints of that at the, I think, last year's shareholder meeting when they talked about, you know, maybe they'll get into mining at some point. You can start to see that they're anticipating having supply chain risk, at least to the extent that they want to grow. Maybe it's not a risk to the company. Maybe it's not a risk to downside of the stock, but it is a risk in terms of their future plans. And you know, there's always that potential with Tesla that maybe they try to grow too quickly, and maybe that backfires, and they get a little bit over their skis, and that can cause some problems. But again, even that, I think we're sort of past that point now with the Model 3 being at scale. And I think Zach has done an awesome job in terms of investor communications and sort of managing the finances too, to where a lot of that risk has been scaled back at this point. So, I mean, that's why I'm in, you know, heavily concentrated in Tesla. I think the risks are extremely low and the upside is extremely high.
Okay, so we have a Twitter follower was asking me to ask you this. What do you think will happen to Tesla and Tesla stock in case something unexpected happens with Elon? Do you think their FLT team, I guess leadership team, is mature enough to execute on Elon's mission? So what's your take on this unexpected
Yeah.
catastrophic event, Elon?
That's definitely another risk that I think in the past would have been extremely significant to Tesla, and would have had potential to, you know, cause the company to, you know, not maybe exist in the future. I think we're past that point. I think Tesla's going to exist in the future, sort of regardless of who's leading it now. To me, it's a question of upside. And I think without Elon Musk, the upside is diminished. So if something like that were to happen, obviously the stock would take a hit and I would have to reassess my position. But I'm also not going to base my investments off of, you know, expecting something bad to happen to Elon. Sure, like there's you want to be protected in case something like that does happen, but I'm not going to assume something like that happens.
Sure. If you do get wiped out with your Tesla stock, like, have you thought about that? Do you have other assets or other things to recover or a plan?
Yeah, so that's a good. We should probably should talk about this earlier with when we were talking about like the concentration of my portfolio. For me,
Sure.
I'm, you know, pretty young still, so I've got another, you know, 30, 40 years to generate income at least. So I am super comfortable with the concentrated position because I do have that, and I have, you know, confidence in my own ability to generate income. So if Tesla went to zero and, you know, I'd still have some other assets, my my net worth would be significantly reduced, obviously, but still confident enough in myself to be able to go out and you know, be fine. So it's not something I worry about. Obviously, it would suck, but it's not, I don't lose sleep over it.
Yeah. I noticed like there are different ways like some people can address mitigating kind of, especially what I call personal risk, because you've got investing risk, but then there's also, it overlaps with personal risk, your retirement, just your standard living, maybe comfort, safety, et cetera. And let's say an investment goes bad, oftentimes, and it wipes you out, hypothetically, it could impact your personal life heavily. But if you can somehow mitigate that personal risk in another way, you know, my approach is like a different basket of assets, right? I noticed a lot of people have, age is a great thing. You know, if you're young, healthy. The other thing I noticed like some people can do is like with higher incomes or higher kind of skills that, let's say, you know, they have a, you have a friend with a decent income, actually a very nice income, and it's very kind of secure job, like even in a depression, like it still goes on. And he's able to take more aggressive investing kind of choices because even if all goes away, it doesn't really matter in the sense where he has such high income, it just continues on, you know? Or at least, you know, confidence to, you know, pull things together, right? But a lot of people, they don't have that to fall back on, you know? Like it took them a long time to get to even saving up, right, what they have, and they don't have that confidence to gain that back. And they might look at some examples of people who are very concentrated in Tesla, like myself or even you, and I think they could get kind of a little bit influenced in the wrong way, thinking, oh, I could also go completely concentrated in this one stock. But my question to them and to is like, hey, wait, are you covering your personal risk? What happens if it goes to zero? Like, are you going to be okay? You know? And, I think that's definitely a question that people need to ask, you know, with risk.
Yeah. That's a super great point all around. And I think that's why I tend to not, you know, I try to steer clear of talking too much about options or talking too much about, you know, how concentrated my position is, and really just try to stick to the facts of what I'm talking about and get my opinions on stuff. But yeah, everybody's different. Everyone's situation is different. You know, if you're 25 and you've got, you know, $10,000 that you want to put into Tesla options and you're making six figures, like you're going to be fine if you lose all that in a weekend. Exactly. Like who cares? Yeah. You're going to make it back. But you know, if you're in your 50s or 60s and you're coming up on retirement and you're going to try to put your whole portfolio in one stock, first of all, the upside is limited because, okay, even if it doubles or triples, like maybe you already had that nest egg secured and maybe you already had that position for yourself sort of locked in versus that 25-year-old with $10,000, like that's a completely different situation. So it's a very important point and probably something that we, I think in the Tesla community and specifically in the Tesla investment community, probably don't spend enough time talking about. And I feel like there's sort of this like, I don't know, like idea that the more invested in Tesla you are, like the better or something like that. Like that's not the case. Like everyone's different. If you like the company, you like to support them, you know, buy the product. If you like the company and want to invest in it, invest in the stock. But there shouldn't be any sort of like negging or shaming anyone for having a smaller position or anything like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. All right. Another Twitter follower question wanting me to ask you, what's the single most impactful thing Elon should pay more attention to or change about current operations at Tesla?
It's something that people on Tesla Motors Club forum talk about a lot. And I think the consensus there is communication. So for me, I don't actually own a Tesla, so I don't have as much insight into this from an individual perspective, but I read as much as I can, pretty much everything about Tesla. And that seems to be the one thing that, you know, keeps coming up. And a lot of people have had issues with service. So the question has been broached to Elon, I think on multiple different conference calls, like, what are you doing to address service? And then every time that question gets asked, you read on the TMC forums, it's like, well, we didn't really mean service. We actually meant communication. And no one actually asked that question properly. So that seems to be the consensus around what the biggest problem is. And I wish I had more insight into specifically what elements of communication have been problematic. But that seems to be a big one. Other than that, I think Elon does a great job. So even that, I think, is a relatively small issue. What are your thoughts on that?
I'd be curious. I completely agree. I mean, if you look back, you know, back in the day, 2012, 2013, they had like George Blankenship early back in the day. He would, you know, correspond with people, and it means a lot, you know, when you have an issue and you correspond with someone who can make a difference, because you're probably not the only one with that issue, you know, and so it actually does a lot. And then a few years after that, you had Jerome Guillen. He was in charge of sales and service, and he did another great job corresponding with people and actually trying to solve problems and issues, and that went a long way. Like, you know, you have one correspondence and the word gets out, and now, you know, lots of stuff is happening. And then I think ever since, like, you know, Elon kind of took over that whole thing, and hasn't, I think, put in, you know, I guess there was that Lyft.
Is that John McNeil?
John McNeil, right? He was in charge of sales. I don't know if he was in charge of service, though.
I can't remember his title.
Yeah. But I think what's going on is Elon is so, like, bogged down with so many more important things, or just, you know, think about it. You're building gigafactories, right? Like, sending thousands of cars on boats that have to get in at a certain time. The factory goes down, you know, right. One day and needs, like, new robot, whatever. It's like, I can't imagine, like, the daily, like, crises, right, that happen in Elon's life. And then SpaceX, right? It's like, boom, and then... Mm-hmm. So, I mean, with that, it's like there's limited time for Elon to really address people's issues, right? I think probably the biggest issue is, Elon needs like a second in hand, like visible person who's going to get down and dirty with customer issues, you know? He's going to solve some problems for people, clear up, you know, miscommunication, clear up vagueness, like get really tight with customers. I think for me, sometimes I think that Elon might be following more like a Steve Jobs, like Apple approach, where it's very rigid communication structure. Like for Steve Jobs, like everything had to go through him, new product announcements, especially. And all communication has to be vetted by marketing and Phil Schiller, and everything is so precise, you know, and they keep a tight rein on their brand. And I feel like in some ways, like it feels like maybe Tesla's trying to model themselves off of that, but they don't have the same type of rigor. And I think Apple marketing, like, and their communication is like on a different world or universe, you know. And to copy it but not to be as good as them, you know, that's not the way to copy, you know. I think a better model is more of the get down to earth, you know, get to know your customers, right? Fix problems, right? And do it that way. But yeah, if any suggestion to Elon, I would say, get someone. I would say Jerome Guillen. Get Jerome, put him in charge of service, give him free rein to communicate with customers and solve issues. And then in a year, it's going to be a completely different scenario. Yeah, I think Jerome will do a fantastic job.
Jerome would be, because you said he was in that role for a while and it was, you know, a lot better at that point in time. But he's doing, I can't remember his exact title now, but he's president of automotive, I think.
Yeah, Jerome is
so president. So he's doing a lot of production stuff now.
Yeah, he's president of automotive. So he oversees basically all of the production, you know, of everything. So Gigafactory supply chain, even, you know, new construction, et cetera.
So I'd hate to take him off a role like that, because I think he's done such a fantastic job with everything, you know, the last couple of years with the progress in Model 3, you know, Gigafactory Shanghai coming up so quickly, Model Y being out of schedule. Yeah. So I'd hate to see him taken off that, but
you don't take him off that. No, you don't take him off that. You just add, you add it to him. He's the type of person, like, I've seen him over the years and I've met him over the years. He's the type of person that will just take it on, you know, and he knows how to delegate and he'll do a good job, I think. But
got it.
Yeah. Anyways, do you think, I want to pass this idea through you. Do you think one of Elon's, I guess, one of the risk factors with Tesla is the sometimes Elon might minimize certain risks and those risks become, potential crises that the company might have a hard time overcoming. Example, alien dreadnought factory, right? This massive automation of, you know, Model 3 line. And you might minimize the risk of that, meaning like, maybe it doesn't work and this will mess up everything, right? Maybe we need more of a, like a tapered or structured rollout of incremental improvement of the production line rather than this like crazy automation in the beginning. And that, like, you know, Elon keeps on mentioning like 2018 was like dark year, you know. And like a lot of Tesla bulls, they kind of minimized Elon saying like Tesla could have gone bankrupt in 2018.
I did too, personally.
Yeah, Elon actually has mentioned that a few times. Like Tesla could have gone bankrupt in 2018. And I think people are like, oh, no, that's impossible, et cetera. But, you know, I don't know. I wasn't inside the company, obviously. I don't know the realities of it. But if you hypothetically just take that at his word, that they were close to bankruptcy, and not just bankruptcy, I think he was, it's pretty dire language. I mean, is that an illustration of kind of like, you know, being so aggressive and ambitious with certain plans that don't work out or become a liability and you have a hard time overcoming? And most of the time you do overcome, but maybe there's a time it just really goes against you somehow. I don't know. What do you think?
Right. Yeah. No, it's an awesome question. I think what gives me comfort in that is that Elon did say that the Model 3 was sort of the last bet the company project. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe things change and maybe they bet the company again, but I think based on all the commentary that we have, the financial strength that they have now with the Model 3 being a, you know, sort of cash cow for them at this point, I think the financial position of the company is very solid where they don't have to do anything like that again.
Sure.
And then the second piece of my answer to that would be, I actually love that about Tesla and I love that about Elon. We wouldn't be at this point if Elon wasn't willing to do those things. And that's what I'm investing in, is my confidence that Elon can achieve great things because he is pushing to accomplish so much in such a dramatically different way than anybody else has done. And that's why Tesla has a huge competitive advantage that nobody else can even come close to even copying, is because Elon has done those things and continues to push the entire organization to think like that and to do those things. So yeah, when you have a whole company thinking like that, there are risks to that, but you don't get that dramatic disruption without those risks. And for me, again, going back to my investment philosophy, that's what I, at this point in my investment life, that's what I'm looking for. So that's why I actually view that as a strong, strong positive.
Yeah. I mean, I agree in the sense that, like, to go from, like, $100 billion market cap to $1 trillion, it's extremely difficult because, I mean, you're talking about encroaching onto established huge players' markets, you know, taking over. You're a target, you know, and unless you have that type of innovation and the willingness to take risks, you're not going to get there to a trillion from 100 billion, you know. And you want to play it safe, you know, after a certain market cap, right? And I mean, another interesting thing is, one of the reasons why I'm bullish on Tesla is because the market is, like, in a way, it has natural moats because of the economies of scale required to produce cars. And so it's hard for a startup really to get in, produce 1 million cars a year, get the economies of scale and the price down. And a large part of also is, like, it's life and death, meaning these cars have to be safe. You don't get a safety reputation unless you have years and years on the road, usually, you know. Like, I think people kind of overlook that, you know, like, oh yeah, is Rivian going to have a chance? But where's their safety reputation, you know? Sure, they might get the early adopters, like the super, you know, people who really like their car, but is the average Joe really going to trust their brand? You know, where's the decades of safety experience, right? How is Rivian going to get to 1 million cars, right? So there's kind of a natural moat in the auto field, and that's what gives me more confidence with Tesla, or because it's like they're the top position and growing their lead over time, and there's a natural moat in that whole industry. So it's hard for a new incumbent to get in. Just like Apple back in the day, right? Like, I was a huge fan of Apple and the iPhone because their moat is, how do you beat the iPhone? You know, you really need to recreate a operating system that is desktop class level, but on a, you know, small screen, touch screen, et cetera. That's extremely difficult to do. You know, there's not many companies that can operate on that level, right, of execution. So it's kind of like a no-brainer, right? Apple is just like, hey, you've got this huge lead, and who's going to take over? You know, who's going to, like, beat you, right? Sure, Android and offering it for free did, you know, dent their, you know, expansion, but, you know, Apple's doing fine because, you know, of who they are. But
that they are, yes.
Yeah. So anyways,
I think that's a great point. And I think Elon added some additional context here too. I think on that third row interview that he did, where he was talking about how difficult it is for new automakers because they're not making any money off service. And so mm-hmm. much of the profit generated by the automotive industry is made off of service. So when you're new, you don't have the economies of scale. Yeah. And then you're also competing against artificially low prices, cost of the vehicles from the margin that's generated on the back half after sale from service.
Yeah,
so you have to compete with that. And Tesla was able to kind of sneak in there because they had this disruptive technology, but no one else can sneak in there anymore because they'd be sneaking into where Tesla's already dominating. So there's no opportunity for that penetration into the market anymore because Tesla took it and it's gone.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I think Elon mentioned it was with parts. That
parts and service, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these automakers.
That's what I meant by service, like all-encompassing,
All-encompassing, yep. Got it. Okay, well, I want to end with, try to close up soon, but there's one other question that a viewer, Twitter follower had, which is which EV product, or which, I guess, you know, EV product have you been impressed with other than Tesla? Which one do you think has the best chance, right, to compete against Tesla? Is there anything out there? Is there any company that you're like, hey, this, you know, company might have a chance, you know? Okay, let's rephrase it. Which company has the best chance to be second place?
I've been making faces through this whole question. There hasn't been one to me. I mean, I will give the Taycan like a little bit of credit because I think they did a good job with what they seem to have been targeting in terms of like track performance.
Yeah.
It seems to have pretty strong track performance, but other than that, the cost is, you know, extreme and the range mm-hmm. is really poor. Mm-hmm. So there were, you know, two major downfalls of that. And obviously Porsche is never going to be volume, so it doesn't really matter anyway. Mm-hmm. That technology can be applied to the VW brand, but, honestly, I have not been impressed with any other offerings to this point in time. I think Rivian's got a little bit of potential in terms of what they're trying to offer, but you know, the Cybertruck is going to really limit their potential, and they also have those issues of being in a new startup and, you know, what we just talked about, so that's troublesome. VW probably, I would say second ran. That seems mm-hmm. to be their goal now, and if they have that clear goal, mm-hmm. They might be able to do that. I think it's just so difficult with an organization of that size to, mm-hmm. you know, sort of swing your direction over to a new path. So mm-hmm. we'll see. I don't have a lot of confidence in anybody, but they're talking about it the most and probably in the best way at this point. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if that leads to results.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, my kind of take on this second place is, I think people underestimate how big a lead Tesla has.
I agree.
It's not something that's like you can overcome, I think, with the culture and product makeup and these companies, right? I mean, these are old companies, you know, established bureaucracies, right? They're good at operations, meaning like, you know, mass manufacturing, whatever. They're not good at innovation, you know? I think to me, it's pretty clear that I don't think the big tech companies are going to let Tesla just dominate the transportation industry. I think it's just too big of a market, and there's just a too limited number of trillion-dollar markets out there. These companies, you know, Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft, they all need trillion-dollar markets to get into, to expand their market cap. And so, I mean, that's the whole reason why Google and Amazon and Apple and all these companies are getting into autonomous driving. You know, you cannot pass up a $1 trillion market, you know, that's an adjacent market, like a tech market or software market, you know, mm-hmm. You've got to at least try. And so I think, whoever Google buys out or Apple buys out or Amazon buys out, like, you know, they'll fork in a ton of money, add in the whole autonomous driving suite and all that stuff. And, you know, there probably will be an Android or a second place, or, you know, I don't think it's very likely a Tesla will own the whole auto market, but I think you will have a competent second place and probably third place as well. It's too lucrative of a market, transportation overall.
That's a really good point, because I was thinking of like currently playing players, but I guess Amazon's sort of in there with the Rivian tie-in, and Google sort of with the Waymo stuff. I don't necessarily ever see them becoming manufacturers, but I could see them mm-hmm. partnering to some extent with a manufacturer, whether that's one of the legacy automakers in a buyout situation or whether they help a new startup sort of ramp up. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that? Do you see partnership?
I mean, I think Amazon is interesting with the Rivian investment because for Amazon, logistics and cost of transport is like existential. Meaning, if they can't get the best price and another company has a significantly better price, they could undercut Amazon's prices and speed. And it's like, that's all of that. What is Amazon's like, competitive advantage, right? It's like price and speed, right? And ease of use or something. And so, because it's existential and Amazon's now turning a profit, they have good cash flow, great market cap, they're gonna spend, they're gonna spend into developing infrastructure and logistics, right? And I think what people don't realize is they look at Tesla as like a vehicle play, a transportation play. But I know, like, back in the day, even JB Straubel was saying, hey, the transportation is about getting people or goods from point A to point B. And what the whole point is, like, it's about logistics, meaning, like, A, with autonomous driving, you're going to transport people from A to B, but also you can transport goods from A to B. What does A to B mean? That means from any point A to any point B, right? And so you have, like, a bunch of, like, stuff that just docked in Long Beach, California. Now, how is that going to go to someone in Texas, right? And point A to B, you can do it autonomously, save a ton of money, get there a lot faster, right? That's Tesla's game plan, right? It's not just with people, it's, logistics as well. And that is just straight head on with Amazon. It's like, you think Jeff Bezos will just let this happen, and let Tesla just completely dominate this field? It's like, no, Jeff Bezos, he's a smart guy,
Yes, yes.
he'll spend the money he needs to get into this as well, I think.
Yeah. And that's what I like about Amazon in particular is I think they still have that sort of mentality. That's whole Jeff Bezos' whole thing is the day one philosophy, where if you become a day two company where you're sort of, in that we've already grown sort of point of view, you're not gonna survive anymore because that's just the end of it. And I think when we look at sort of Google, Apple, Amazon's probably the closest to being like day one sort of mentality. Apple's probably the closest to being the day two sort of mentality, and Google's probably in the middle, would be my assessment of it. So yeah, I think Amazon definitely want to watch, and they've sort of shown their cards there a little bit with the Rivian investment. So yeah, that's gonna be super interesting to see how that develops.
I think, like, my take on Google is I think actually I give them more credit than in the sense that they are investing so heavily on in AI and deep learning. You don't have, I think, a better company with as much expertise in that area, and they are doing a lot under the hood to really just expand, I think, what they're doing.
Would you put them ahead of Amazon in terms of, I know it's sort of maybe not the best way to even classify it, but
I mean, I think in terms of tech, Google's way ahead in terms of real tech, like AI tech, deep learning, cutting edge tech. Like, Google is really pioneering in that sense, and it doesn't necessarily, like, show very visibly to a lot of people, because who's going to really look into the what deep learning really is and how it impacts whatever. It's just Amazon is so ruthless in just growing their revenue, good whatever 15%, 20% a year, and it's so systematic and structured. I think they have a lot of cards in their hands, and they kind of just turn on whatever they need to turn on to keep on boosting the revenue at the rate that they want to. But I think with Amazon, I look at Amazon as, like, I think Amazon is one of the, historically, like, look back thousands and thousands of years. Has there ever been a company the size of Amazon where they are managing so many different projects and initiatives in so many different areas, and those projects and things are managed very well? Like, it's just like, I just can't think of another company that is at the size and complexity in terms of the multitude of things that they're doing, but they're managed very well, like all of this stuff. And I think, if history ends today, Jeff Bezos goes down as probably, like, one of the greatest managers, managing of managers, right? An execution across this complexity. And I'm not saying that, he's gonna per se innovate. I don't think he's the greatest innovator per se, let's say like Elon Musk per se. I think Elon's whole, like, thing is Elon creates something new, that he wants. And Elon has a better, bigger imagination, right? I think he's more ambitious in that sense to create something new. But Jeff Bezos, man, that guy, his like ruthless execution and fine management of like all of these projects and people and stuff. It's like, yeah, it's like historic,
It's
man.
mind-blowing. Yeah, I
No,
totally agree.
it really is.
That's one of the interesting differences for me between Amazon and Google's. I think Amazon's more involved in the physical world, which I think may be a little bit more, self-driving tech, that's obviously, we'll see how that develops. But when I think about like logistics and supply chain and managing through all that stuff, like Amazon is so much better positioned to take on projects like that than someone like Google is, just because of their areas of expertise and how they've sort of come to be are so differently positioned in like physical world versus more of the technological world. Obviously both overlap, but just sort of a split there.
Definitely. All right, Rob, I want to thank you for taking this time out to just chat with me and my audience. And so
Yeah,
I wish you the
absolutely.
best. Can you let us know about your podcast, how to find your podcast? Also, you have a YouTube channel. Let us know your name, so people can
Yeah.
find out your
Yeah,
episodes there.
before we do that though, I just want to give you a lot of credit. I mean, you were the one of the first people that I started reading on Tesla Motors Clubs back in, as you said, like 2012, 2013, and your understanding of the company was so well developed at that point in time. Like it was just such a pleasure to have access to that at that time and really helped me form my opinions on the company. So, just want to give you a lot of credit for, recognizing the story so quickly and, sharing your expertise on it. So, appreciate that.
Thanks for bringing that up, because my whole point back then was actually I wanted to help people like actually think through things, like think a little deeper than just the shallow, just like, oh, it's a great company or not, like
Right.
why, and I think, just looking back now, 8 years later, right? And I think there's a lot more people out there that understand things and on a deeper level, but are getting those habits now. It's like, hey, let's think about this deeper. And I think it's gonna be it's gonna bear fruit, not just with Tesla as an investment, but with a lot of other things in life. So yeah, definitely. Yeah, thanks for sharing.
Yeah, you've always been like super like TMC, especially nowadays, it tends to get, pretty hyped up, but you've always been there, just wanting to discuss the business and discuss the risks and the opportunities. And that's a that at the end of the day, that's what I'm interested in doing. Like I like Tesla, but for me it's I like it because of all the positive things they're doing. It's not like I'm just like a Tesla fan. It's just
Exactly,
there's a lot of potential for the business and stuff. So yeah, it's awesome to have that. Definitely appreciate it. In terms of your first question though, yeah, I'm on YouTube. Just search for Tesla Daily, Rob Mauer, or whatever. Same thing with podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much everywhere.
Okay, Tesla Daily Podcast. All right,
Yep.
man. Okay,
And then
Rob, we'll see you.
on Twitter
Oh,
at Tesla Podcast
at
too.
Tesla
Sorry.
Podcast. Okay, all right, we'll see you around, Rob. Thanks a
All
lot.
right, awesome.
Okay,
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate
all
it.
right, bye.